Freedom! Freedom! Freedom!
Kwame Nkrumah was a visionary, a revolutionary, and a pathbreaker.
He dared to challenge colonial subjects and the colonial powers so that ordinary African people could organize for their independence.
At long last, the battle has ended.
He had a vision, he had a dream about Ghana.
He broke with the past of bourgeois, gradualist, nationalist politicians.
We dedicate ourselves not only in the struggle to emancipate other territories in Africa. Our independence is meaningless unless it's linked up to the total breakdown of the African continent.
Kwame Nkrumah was the greatest pan-Africanist and socialist revolutionary organizer that the African world has seen, and if the masses of the people pick up on his ideas, Africa will be free.
Kwame Nkrumah became Ghana's first prime minister of an independent state. The Gold Coast now became Ghana.
We're very, very proud, you know, because for the first time, we had a Ghanaian in charge of Ghana.
From now on, there is a new African in the world. That new African is ready to fight his own battle and show that, after all, the black man is capable of managing the whole affairs.
To symbolize that the Gold Coast was now an independent country, Kwame Nkrumah and his Convention People's Government decided to change the name from the Gold Coast to the historically ancient name of Ghana. Ancient Ghana, going back as far back as the 5th century, was an ancient kingdom in West Africa, and therefore Nkrumah and the CPP decided to revert back to this historic name.
Dr. Kwame Nkrumah became known later as Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. And Osagyefo in the Akan language of Ghana means savior. But he was also known as Showboy and had another series of nicknames to indicate the extent of his charisma, which was electric.
His slogan was, "Thought without action is empty, and action without thought is blind," so that we need men and women who think like men and women of action and act like men and women of thought.
The task then was to begin to build a new nation, united nation, a nation in which its people saw themselves first and foremost as Ghanaians, rather than Ashantis and Ewes and Dagombas and so on. So that was the task. The primary task was to build a new united Ghana with a distinct Ghanaian identity.
The challenges that Nkrumah faces start well before independence. In 1954, the Minister of Finance, who was Kamla Bedima, stands up and presents a paper to the cabinet saying the cocoa price is going to go down, that basically chocolate makers worldwide are overstocked. The price of chocolate's going to go down. There's no market growth predictable in future. And the conclusions drawn in cabinet then are what we want to do in terms of social change, advancing the need for education for all, health service, building a deep water port at Tema, improving the infrastructure so that the supply of farm produce to towns and so on can be enhanced and so on. We're going to have to do that fast. So they spend like drunken sailors.
Some of the industrialization projects he carried out were the building of roads. There was various schools and hospitals. He poured a great deal of money into education.
In a relatively short period of about 6 years, educational institutions had been built in all the districts of Ghana. He had introduced fee-free and compulsory education for every Ghanaian child.
All students, both girls and boys, from primary school to higher education.
They're using up reserves because it's not going to last. They know that they are bad times coming. So that is the fundamental challenge, that if you want to reconstruct a state, if you want to make a modern state, if you want to industrialize a state and so on, you need cash. There's no serious outside investment at the time. There's a lot of bent outside investment at the time, which is another story. But the challenge he faces basically is a decline in government revenue. And it's fundamentally a government revenue-based development project that he's on about with the first 2 5-year plans.
The construction of the hydroelectric project in Akosombo was key to the industrialization of Ghana.
With declining state revenues, with an increasingly hostile Western world, but I think also an indifferent Eastern world, Russia did always talk about supporting him, but in terms of what actually turns up on the doorstep in terms of cash or things, not very much to show for it.
He has gone to the US to raise funds for the construction of the Akosombo Dam. The US didn't want to support, and they were dragging their feet. So he reluctantly had to make a move to the Soviet Union to support. And that was when America decided that it's, you know, Kaiser.
You have to remember, in the world, there was sort of East versus the West. We were involved in what they called the Cold War, you know, communism versus capitalism. Africa was caught in the middle. All the countries that had become liberated and were fighting for their freedom were vying for that country to be in either the Western camp or the Eastern camp. Kwame Nkrumah and the parliament decided that they must be non-aligned. They were not supporting the West against the East, nor the East against the West, but they were moving forward toward Pan-Africanism.
Nkrumah's vision for Ghana was very much a microcosm of his vision for the entire African continent.
On the eve of Ghana's independence, Nkrumah made a statement that the independence of Ghana was meaningless unless it was linked up with the total liberation of the African continent.
We dedicate ourselves not only in the struggle to emancipate all the territories in Africa. Our independence is meaningless unless it is linked up with the total liberation of the African continent.
And so it was, Vice President, that from the very first day of her independence, Ghana served as a rear base for the total liberation of our continent.
Nkrumah gave practical expression to this declaration by, first of all, organizing the All African People's Conference of 1958, at which all the liberation movements in Africa participated and formulated strategies for overthrowing colonialism.
Nkrumah gave enormous logistical and practical support to various liberation movements, such as Patrice Lumumba of the Congo, Amilcar Cabral of Guinea-Bissau, and Kenneth Kaunda of present-day Zambia, and many others.
He invited George Padmore to serve as his advisor for African affairs. And he also invited the man who had been the president of the 5 Pan-African Congress, the first Pan-Africanist Congress, all the way through the 5th Pan-Africanist Congress, W.E.B. Du Bois. He invited him to serve as his minister for Encyclopedia Africana.
Ghana had become the Socialist Republic of Ghana because healthcare, education was free.
There's an African saying which, simply put, means he who has his mouth in the kitchen of his enemy can never be liberated. And Nkrumah sought to take our mouth from the kitchen of the metropolis.
Kwame Nkrumah believed in developing a new way forward where African economies could be transformed to cater for the needs of their own people without being dependent totally on external forces.
One of the things that Nkrumah did was to establish a huge cattle ranch to provide the meat that our people needed. He also established a tannery to produce the leather, and then establish a shoe factory to turn the leather that has been produced by the tannery into shoes and other leather products for our people.
1964, I was 21 years old. I came to Ghana, and what I witnessed was just phenomenal. I didn't want to leave. I see new schools being built every day, free education. I see new hospitals being built, new clinics, free health care. I see factories being built by Africans, not by Chinese, not by South Koreans, but by Africans.
In Ghana, you go there and you see African pilots. You see African news presenters. You hear African music, African clothes. And now in Ghana, we got our own national bank.
Nkrumah also established the Black Star Line, which was a shipping line to promote trade between the African countries and Africans in the diaspora and so on.
The significance of the flag of Ghana, and that is the symbolism held in the star.
Just as Kwame Nkrumah said that the African can determine his own future if he's left alone. And the star, it really represents that star that Marcus Garvey, the Honorable Marcus Garvey, you know, had for the Black Star Liner.
This would have moved Africa toward economic independence. That antagonized the West.
And particularly Nkrumah's ambitions to unite the African continent within the context of a union government for Africa also made Nkrumah and his ideas a danger to imperialist interests.
Cocoa, at that time, alongside gold, was one of the key primary products that Ghana was exporting in order to derive foreign exchange and capital to manage its economy.
Prices began to decline considerably, and therefore this correlated with the declining living standards of most Ghanaians.
From a high of £400 per ton of cocoa in sometime 1965, it had fallen to about £80.
We also have to remember that this decline in the cocoa prices was manipulated by various Western powers who wished to impose an economic squeeze on Kwame Nkrumah's government. And as a result, many Ghanaians became economically and also politically disenchanted with Nkrumah's government.
He pegs wages at a time when inflation is raging. Not only does he do that, he demands that workers contribute to a compulsory savings scheme. And that meant that you took some of your wages, but the rest of your wages were produced as a bond which you could cash in, I can't remember, 3 years or 4 years' time. And of course, these bits of paper were never produced.
In addition to that, there was also a rise in corruption amongst officials, state officials and CPP officials, that led many Ghanaians to question the CPP.
The National Liberation Movement had taken the part of terrorism against Nkrumah. Supporters of Nkrumah were being killed on a regular basis. They were exploding bombs across the country and so on, and generally creating a situation of insecurity.
He had a vision for the future. He was not really working for that year. He does not work for the public consumption. He was just doing it for the right reason. And that is why a lot of people fell apart and started to be confused and, doubting his intentions. They thought he was misguided.
Imperialist forces stepped up their opposition, stepped up their action. There was about six or seven attempts on Nkrumah's life.
In the 60s, there were many assassination attempts on Nkrumah. And one of them actually took place in the Flagstaff House, where he had his office and also his residence.
A police officer was planted to shoot Nkrumah.
This was a police officer on guard duty who attempted to shoot him with his rifle.
He came and just opened the door, and at that time Nkrumah was behind that door. It was a very heavy door. So he knocked him with the door and he fell. And Nkrumah himself disarmed him because he knew some basic techniques. Nkrumah liked jogging, he likes walking, he likes exercising, he likes doing judo, karate, you know, these little things.
And you can see from the picture behind me, you know, Nkrumah putting down an assassin, you know, somebody who tried to assassinate him.
These activities of sabotage, bombing, continued throughout the regime. Some of the actions he had to take to deal with the sabotage included the Preventive Detention Act, where people who were involved in this act of sabotage and destabilization were imprisoned.
Today, countries like the United States of America, countries like the United Kingdom, have passed legislation which is similar to the Preventive Detention Act. Are we to say today that David Cameron is a dictator? Are we to say that Barack Obama is a dictator? Because they've essentially passed the same laws. Those laws were passed in response to the anarchy and recklessness of the opposition to Nkrumah. I remember the story which was put out by the opposition to Nkrumah, that Nkrumah was keeping people in jail and maltreating them and so on. And they got photographs published in London and other places. Eventually, it turned out that those photographs had been taken from a Togolese prison rather than a Ghanaian prison.
Now, I'm only beginning this research. In 2 days in the National Archives in Washington, apart from finding that the consul was helping people form opposition political parties, I also found that in 1964, so 2 years before the coup, the head of the CIA has a meeting with the head of the State Department, their foreign office, and says, I really think General Ankrah would be the best person to take over. Now, if he says that in February 1964, it means he has already been dealing with the people plotting the takeovers and deciding whom to help with the takeover.
There's one very, very significant cable which was dispatched from the British High Commission in Accra, and the British High Commissioner in Accra then was A.W. Snelling, who dispatched a cable to the Home Office which simply said that the British establishment had to get rid of Nkrumah because he was making the African too politically conscious. What damning evidence.
The factors that led to the coup that overthrew Kwame Nkrumah's government can be separated into internal factors and external factors. Among them were the declining economic situation in the country, whereby 1965, Ghana only had £500,000 in sterling in their reserve account. Nkrumah's perceived meddling, interference with the army and the police, particularly after the 1964 assassination attempt on him. He had removed the police chief, and in the subsequent year, 1965, he'd also demoted several of the generals. Another important factor was also the fact that he had set up a new military structure known as the Presidential Own Guard Regiment, with its own security apparatus, and this was perceived as a threat by the army. However, the most critical external factor in the coup d'etat was the plotting and conspiracy by the United States of America, Britain and France, with their neo-colonial agents in the army, the Ghana Army and the Ghana Police Force. They acted in concert to overthrow Kwame Nkrumah.
Now, all of these forces, Western intelligence forces and Western governments, plotted systematically against Nkrumah, recruited local collaborators and so on, in order to get rid of Nkrumah, not because Nkrumah was bad for the Ghanaian and African people, but simply because Nkrumah wanted to stop the exploitation of our resources for the benefit of others.
Nkrumah had a slogan that when you're talking to the imperialists, and he's smiling. He comes in, oh, hello, hello, how are you? Then he's making profit on you. But when the empress comes to sit with a straight face, it means the business is straightforward.
In 1965, Osagyefo Kwame Nkrumah wrote a book called Neocolonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism. In this book, Kwame Nkrumah lays out the grand master plan for Europe and America's recolonization of Africa, and did it elaborately. The Western world read that book and said, this man has to go.
24th of February 1966 coup took place when Nkrumah was out of the country. He was invited by President Ho Chi Minh the leader of North Vietnam, to participate in peace initiatives to end the Vietnam War between Vietnam and America.
Troops were moved from Kumasi and Accra. They attacked Flagstaff House, fought the president's own regimental guard. After that, they took over broadcasting. They made an announcement to the country that the myth surrounding Nkrumah had been broken.
That was one of the worst moments in the history of the entire African continent, the celebration of traitors. I spent that whole morning moving around Accra with friends of mine, and we saw the carnage which was being unleashed on the city by these soldiers. I saw Nkrumah's security men arrested and beaten up. I saw them with bayonets in their chests and so on.
He asked me whether I understood the meaning of a coup. And I told him that, well, when the military takes over from a civilian government, they said, he cracked the joke that is the additional meaning, but they said, this is the beginning of a history in Africa. There will be several coups in Africa, and Africa will sink. And then a new Africa will develop out of the mess.
Nkrumah went into exile in Guinea, but managed to keep touch with the people of Ghana through frequent broadcasts.
I came to Guinea early 68, and this is when we proposed to Kwame Nkrumah to allow us to bring him back to Ghana, because we were ready to bring him back with guns blazing. I mean, we were young and we were ready and excited, pumped up. Kwame Nkrumah looked at us, you know, and smiled. He took the guns out of our hands and put books in our hands. Quite frustrating for me at the time. I didn't really understand. But thank God he did. In his infinite wisdom, he knew we didn't know what we were doing. He knew that we needed to study.
As co-president of Guinea, he helped shape economic and political policies and so on. But in addition to that, Nkrumah wrote a lot in Guinea.
Nkrumah called the time in Guinea one of the most productive periods of his life. He wrote a number of books during that period.
He maintained contact with progressive embassies such as China, Cuba, and other countries.
He continued to have relations with various Pan-Africanists all over the world and who went to meet him in Conakry.
In the last 3 years of Nkrumah's life, he experienced deteriorating health. Initially, the cause of his illness was unknown, and he sadly, tragically died of prostate cancer in April 1972.
We pay homage today to the African of the Millennium on his 102nd birthday. 21st of September has always been a day of inspiration, and this remains true today.
Let us use the memory of this great leader, President Kwame Nkrumah Osagyefo, to spur our continent on to the next phase of the vision of the founders of our nations.
I believe his greatest legacy is the legacy that hasn't been realized yet, which is his vision of Africa, because from the onset he said that Ghana's independence, being the first African country to be independent, he didn't see it as the destination. He just said that, you know, Ghana's independence will be meaningless unless that victory leads to the total liberation of Africa. So Ghana's independence was on the path to that vision. So I believe that the realization of that vision is going to be his most important legacy. And I believe that it's going to be a generation right now who are going to rise up and realize that.